This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 29th of April 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme...
When individuals get crowbars and start prying open doors to loot, they're not protesting. They're not making a statement. They're stealing.
A curfew across the US city of Baltimore brings some much-needed calm after days of violent rioting. We'll reflect on what ignited this outpouring of rage with our studio guests Tim Marshall and Ivor Gaber. Also ahead, diplomatic fury in Australia as Indonesia ignores pleas for clemency and executes two convicted drug smugglers.
Australia respects the Indonesian system. We respect Indonesia's sovereignty. But we do deplore what's been done. And this cannot be simply business as usual.
Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott promises there will be consequences. What might they be? We'll discuss all that. Plus a shake-up in Saudi Arabia's royal succession plan. And we'll also talk a little bit about the UK elections. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Ivor Gaber, Director of Cities Course in Political Journalism, and from the what and the why.com, formerly diplomatic editor at Sky News, Tim Marshall. Ivor and Tim, welcome to you both. After days of violent riots that swept across the city, Baltimore finally enjoyed the sound of silence last night as a curfew appeared to provide some much needed calm. With about 2,000 National Guard officers at the ready, as well as state law enforcement and authorities from outside the city, Baltimore was taking no chances after the furious anger that erupted on Monday. However, parts of the city still carry the hallmarks of the week's unrest, with much of the damage done on the same day the funeral was held for Freddie Gray, a 25-year-old black man whose death in police custody ignited the riots. Tim Marshall, it's another month, another crisis in an American city. This is becoming a bit of a theme now, isn't it?
It is, but I think unless you confront the totality of it, you're not going to get to the bottom of what's going on. It is easy to say, because it's true, there is American police brutality, and the way they police is unacceptable to many people outside of the states and inside the states. All that is true. I think it is clear there is a problem of racism. But if we only focus on that, you're not going to get to other root problems. Baltimore, 630,000 people, 63% of them are black. More than half the police force in Baltimore is black. The mayor is black. The chief of police is black. More than half of the city council is black.
So in complete contrast to Ferguson, Missouri. Yes.
Now, that does not mean that whatever happened to that poor man with his back broken was not for the original reasons I came up with. It may be police racism. It may be police brutality. That is to be decided. But if you only look at that, and you don't look at the statistics in Baltimore, and I'll give you the most important one, if there is about 400,000 black people in Baltimore and there were several hundred rioters, I think it does a disservice to the majority of people in that city who did not go out. And as the President America Obama said, get baseball bats and smash up things. I think you do a disservice and an insult to them because they did not come out and throw police cars over. They stood there, many of them absolutely appalled at what was happening in their own neighbourhoods. And if you just say, oh, well, you know, people are angry. Yes, the people are angry, and I think people are right to be angry. But I think the majority of people in that city looked at those, what were many of them, young thugs, and they don't like what they see.
Ivor Gaber, when we look at the way protests are covered by the media, you know, we cover things when there's a riot. And if there had been a very peaceful protest in Baltimore over the past few days, we wouldn't be talking about possible police brutality, would we?
We wouldn't, but there's a more worrying backdrop to this in terms of media, because we've seen over the last, I can't exactly measure, over the last few months, a number of items like this. Now, I don't believe, unfortunately, that these just suddenly happened over the last few months. I think they've been happening, incidents with mainly young black men being savagely attacked by police, I think are almost commonplace. That's an exaggeration. But all of a sudden, we have the first big story hits the news desk and it suddenly becomes the story of the day. Now, there is no blame attached to anybody there. But that tends to be, as Tim well knows, how news desks react.
Yeah. But that's surely a good thing now, that actually, because for so long these deaths were ignored.
Yeah. And then it will go, quote, out of fashion, and the deaths or the beatings will continue.
Will probably continue. You're right. But we used to have a saying in news. This is how we count in news. One, two, trend.
Yeah.
And then the riots, of course, haven't always happened, because a riot of these scales happening anywhere would be news. But it's the fact of sensitization, to use a posh word. People go out on the streets because, it's happening here just as it happened there. And so that's where the process, and that's where the media's role becomes problematic. Because on the one hand, we're all staunch defenders of freedom of the media, and we certainly don't want to censor any of this. But on the other hand, journalists have to be very aware of possible consequences.
Steve, I mean, please don't read me the wrong way, that because I've tried to introduce all these other factors into it, that I underestimate the scale of the problem in the United States, of racism, of police brutality, of the way that they police their inner cities, and in fact elsewhere. I've lived in the United States. I have seen with my own eyes the problems that people face there. It's just that if you don't take on these other factors, you're never going to get to the bottom of what's going on. And there is a crisis within many of these communities. And you saw some of the mothers and fathers just appalled, realizing just how bad things have got over there.
But where does Obama stand in this? Not him personally, but we in the journalistic, political, intellectual community, call us what as well, 8 years ago, thought the first black president, things have changed.
But they don't change that quickly, do they?
But 8 years on, if you like, things seem even worse. The polarization, the black and white polarization, we haven't seen scenes like this since going back to riots in Los Angeles, etc.
Well, it's funny, Ivor brings that up. That was 1992. And in fact, yesterday or today, I forget which, is actually the anniversary in 1992 of when the jury acquitted four white police officers of beating Rodney King, which is one of the most astonishing jury verdicts you could come up with.
So and he said then. It's quite obvious.
Rodney King said then in that amazing speech of his, you know, we've all just got to get together, let's never let this happen again. And that was 1992. And I was right, it is going to keep happening. But you've got to address the crisis in the inner cities as well as all the other things.
So is it just about, not just, but are you saying that poverty is the main cause?
Poverty, lack of education, single parent families, all of which the black communities of America struggle with more than most other communities.
But it is black.
And the cause of that may well be racism. But unless you're going to start dealing with that, it's not as simple as just saying there's a systemic problem in the police force. Because what about all those other people in Baltimore who did not go out and riot, who also live in the same areas? The vast majority of people did not behave in that manner.
Well, it's the same in London.
But step away from the riots for one moment and go back to the original protests. Now, if you're within the police force in Baltimore, you can say, well, look, the people that have been accused of breaking Freddie Gray's spine, snapping it in two, have been suspended. There is an investigation. But you may well also be looking at this and going, well, you know, when Eric Garner was killed in New York, there was an investigation. And when Mike Brown was killed in Ferguson, Missouri, there was an investigation. But nothing happened.
You'd hear the same echo of investigations of in London with the Independent Police IPCC. It's very rare, and Tim, I'm trying to think of the last time a police officer in this country faced criminal charges. There was the phenomenal case captured on YouTube of the newspaper salesman Ian Tomlinson, who wasn't even part of the riot, clearly being, dare I say, attacked by the police officer, led to his subsequent death, and the police officer was allowed to resign from the force. I think the same problem exists here.
And that is the fundamental problem, Tim, isn't it? Let's leave aside, let's separate the riot from the anger. The anger is understandable because this is,
entirely,
as we're saying at the start,
justified, yes.
If someone say to you, did you hear about that black guy who was killed by police in America, you'd be like, oh, hang on, but Which one are we talking about here? Yeah, within the past 6 months.
Yeah, look, no justice, no peace is a cry, and it is absolutely true. It's just that you can have, there's a degrees of no peace, and I just think when it descends into that lawlessness, when it descends into gangs coming in from outside of the areas that were smashed up to smash them up and loot them, and incite the young kids there where the local people look on horrified. I think when it gets to that level, the no justice, no peace, you're working against trying to solve the problem, because you've got this horrified majority looking at that thinking, oh, the police should just go in and hard, they should just do this, they should just do that. Oh, look what they're all like. You're actually playing into the hand of racism.
Let's move on now. After 10 years on death row, legal appeals, ministerial and consular lobbying, a parliamentary motion and many calls from the Australian Prime Minister and Foreign Minister, nothing, it seems, could convince Indonesia to spare the lives of two convicted drug smugglers. But with the Foreign Minister's request for the announcement not to be made on Anzac Day, a sacred day of recognition in Australia, also ignored, the diplomatic cracks were indeed showing before the executions took place. Australia has taken the step of recalling its ambassador to Indonesia, with Prime Minister Tony Abbott now mulling his earlier threat that should the executions go ahead, there would be consequences. Ivar Gaber, Australia and Indonesia have had a difficult relationship in recent years. There was the revelation within the Edward Snowden files that Australia had been spying on Indonesia, and yet Tony Abbott had said Indonesia is our biggest partner, our closest ally. It's becoming a little bit harder now for them, isn't it?
Well, it's a very difficult relationship. You haven't mentioned, but one of the major sores in that relationship are the boat people, which the Australians see the Indonesians are complicit in. I worked in Australia for a year or so, and I was in Sydney. And I remember somebody from Perth saying to me, do you know what our nearest capital city is? And I guessed Adelaide. And he said, no. And I said, Darwin. He said, no. He said, Jakarta. Western Australia is closer to Indonesia than it is to Sydney and Melbourne and the Eastern Seaboard. So they are, it's dare I say, is it a UK-France type relationship, our closest neighbours and our most difficult ones? But clearly, both in terms of geography, but also in terms of trade, these are two very important partners. But there is clearly a difficulty that no Australian Prime Minister could sit by and do nothing about the execution of two nationals, particularly because the legal process, we're led to believe, was still ongoing. So I think Abbott had to lead in that direction, but I don't think the rift will be ongoing.
Tim Marshall, is this one of those diplomatic issues that, well, both sides need to do something for show, but actually behind the scenes, everything will go on as per usual? Or do you sense that actually for Australia, no, this was a line that was crossed,
no,
and it's going to affect their relationship?
I don't. If you look at the trade between the two countries, Indonesia is a country of 250 million people, Australia 23 million. Now, which has the stronger hand? The Indonesians have the stronger hand in this. Of course, Mr. Abbott has to come out and say he's appalled. He may well be. Of course, there is genuine anger. He says this cannot be business as usual. But the reality of these relationships at great state level is that within a few days, weeks or months, they will have got past this. The Australian cattle will still be slaughtered and the beef sent to Indonesia and the rubber or whatever else comes the other way. And they will carry on having their relationship. They both are fearful of China and the growth of China. Fearful, they are anxious about it. There is more for them to cooperate on than there is to divide them. And yes, they might be very angry. It will be business as usual eventually.
It's worth just pointing out as well that it's within Indonesia itself, it's a very popular move to execute drug smugglers. There is no domestic pressure to alleviate, to change policy, if anything, in the opposite direction. And, you know, there is a cultural difference, if you like, in those countries which don't believe in capital punishment and those that do. And therefore, this is merely, as far as the Indonesians are concerned, a matter of external relations.
Tim Marshall, what are the steps that a nation can take against another? Because there is, you know, you can have this, well, we'll call in the ambassador to have a strongly worded conversation.
Well, that's number two, and it's not very high at the scale. I mean, number one is you just sort of voice your displeasure through a cable, or you say it into a microphone. Number two is you call in the ambassador, then you ring up the media and say, by the way, we've called it, or you let them know. So it's a public slap. If you really want to get tasty, you actually give them advance warning and get the cameras down there to see the ambassador's car sweeping into the wherever it is. And then you start moving up to withdrawing completely the ambassador back home for several weeks. Then you even think about suspending relations. Then you break relations and then you go to war. Okay. They're not quite there yet.
No, okay.
There is an intermediate. There are a few intermediate
there
stages.
There are a few above
economic
that,
sanctions.
Exactly.
Shorthand.
But, you know, as Tim says, a country of 23 million introducing sanctions against a country of 250 million. Well, we're doing it against Russia, but it don't work.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Michael 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. When we're back, we'll talk about Saudi Arabia. We may also talk about the elections here. Plus, if there's time, possibly Brian Williams.
From the streets of Kabul to a girls' school in the shadow of the Hindu Kush, London-based artist George Butler spent 3 weeks in Afghanistan, reporting on life in the war-torn country through that most old-fashioned of methods, paper and ink.
This is in Herat, and as always, I just picked a spot that I thought I could describe what I was witnessing as best as I could. It's very much that balance in Afghanistan of how long it's safe to be there, but also that drive to try and describe to people what it's like in a place that is almost always described as dangerous or unsafe.
Art of War, a Monocle film, now playing on Monocle.com.
Who said print was dead? Certainly none of the guests who sit down with Tyler Brulé and Tom Edwards to dissect the best and brightest, glowing and glossiest in the magazine industry. Every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time, Studio One at Midori House can play host to art directors and publishers, photographers and columnists as they flick through their favourite journals, shred some of the periodicals they could do without, and dispense snippets of industry gossip.
Our paper is incredibly expensive and it's imported from Italy. And we had that discussion about the paper, but actually we decided the paper is too important. It's just too important that it looks good, that it's consistent. It's a little bit like hymn book paper, and it creates the impression that we've been around for a very, very, very long time.
Occasionally, they also offer up some sharp opinions on where this turbulent sector might be heading. Join Tyler Brulé or Tom Edwards when Tyler's on the road for The Stack, Monocle 24's weekly print industry review and analysis show, every Saturday at 10 a.m. London time. Make it part of your must-listen lineup on iTunes or SoundCloud.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. My guests today, Ivor Gaber and Tim Marshall. The world's longest-serving foreign minister is out of a job after Saudi Arabia's new king, King Salman, gave his cabinet a reshuffle, also installing a new heir to the throne. The king's nephew and former head of a crackdown force on al-Qaeda now takes over as crown prince, the first time a grandson of the country's founder has become heir instead of a son. Tim Marshall, when you look at the Saudi royal family, as I'm sure you look at the Saudi royal family every day, what do these changes tell us about what's going on in Saudi Arabia under King Salman? Are these actually big changes, or is it a little bit of window dressing?
Forgive my cynicism. I'm desperately looking to be cheerful and say everything's going to be all right. It probably will all be all right, but I'm afraid it's, I think, and Ivor hopefully will disagree with me, it's a bit of window dressing. The Crown Prince is only 56. The guy that's been appointed.
Only 56.
What? He's a spring chicken.
That's young for a Saudi.
Exactly. But I remember him when he was the Interior Minister, and he was one tough cookie. He is a hardliner. He has got very good relationship with the Wahhabis. Basically, Saudi Arabia is run by two pillars of the establishment. One is the Wahhabi religious establishment. The other is the Saudi family. So they thought they'd call the country after themselves. It's been like calling Timland or something, Marshall Land. They're called Saudi
Arabia. You're thinking of it, aren't you?
Well, Give me time. Sorry, but the point being that they have jumped a generation, so at least when this octogenarian dies, they're not scrubbing around trying to find another 8-year-old to take over. They've got a 55-year-old there being groomed to take over when he's in his 60s or something. But that does not mean that they are heading a pace towards reform, because he is a very tough cookie, and he is a religious man, and I don't believe he is the man who's going to open massive reforms. Hopefully there'll be some reforms.
Ivor Gaber, how hopeful are you that there are going to be some reforms?
Well, I'll play the part that Tim has assigned to me. I'm one of life's optimists. I do think it's quite important to jump generations, even if the new incumbent is a hardliner. It does give a different outlook. I mean, we've been dealing. The previous king was in his 90s, when nobody's quite sure how old. Your world outlook must be different. The new generation and some of the new office holders are in their 30s, which is young, even Steve, by your standards.
Thank you.
Must bring a different outlook. Now, I temper my remarks when I think back, when I was thinking of the octogenarians in power in Tehran, and when they had a younger man, Ahmadinejad, it wasn't exactly a breakthrough in terms of progressive
that's
politics.
That's partly my point. And the other point is that even if he did want to, let's say he wanted to give women driving licenses.
Oh, that's outrageously radical.
He might want to, but what about the Wahhabi establishment? If the Wahhabi religious establishment say we're not having that, he'll be out. There'll be somebody else. And so it'll be incremental, incredibly slow reform.
Well, the bad news on that front is Saudi Arabia's only woman minister, in fact, she was a deputy minister, has been sacked. She was deputy minister of education, did see through certain reforms, but when she came out with the outlandish idea of letting Saudi schoolgirls do physical education, that was just pushing it too far. So regrettably, although I seek to disagree with you, the straws in the wind are not all blowing in the positive direction.
Tim, you mentioned two groups that essentially are quite important for Saudi Arabia, the royal family and the Wahhabis. But there's also arguably another constituency which we should talk about, which is Western nations and Western companies that work in Saudi Arabia, be they oil companies, be they wonderful arms industries here in Britain and in America and elsewhere. And it's interesting when you talk to those people, they're not that keen on reform in Saudi Arabia either, are they? Because they quite like the fact that it's, you know, in inverted commas, stable.
I knew you were going to say stable.
They love stability. Yes, they love a bit of stability.
It's the bottom line. I remember going over a few times when there was a bombing campaign to try and get the Westerners out. It was a very, very smart tactic by Al-Qaeda about 10 years ago. They were bombing the compounds where the Western workers, and we got hold of some figures that suggested at least 30% of the Western workers actually did flee. Now, these were very sensitive numbers, because there comes a certain point, if enough Westerners can be forced to run away, when the oil industry can no longer function properly. And at that point, Saudi Arabia collapses, and that's what they want, to collapse it in order to take it over. And they were on their way, and it was a very smart move, and it was actually this interior ministry who's now the Crown Prince, who actually took them on and actually dismantled them to a great extent. It made his career. So that's why they want stability. It's why the Wahhabis want stability. It's why the Sauds want stability. And it's actually why there is a significant proportion of the population that doesn't really want that much of a reform, because they're worried about what comes next. And that includes the 30% of the country who are Shia. If you start taking that lid off, I'm not saying you shouldn't, but if you take that lid off, you look what's happening across their borders.
So why has the Saudis upped the ante in terms of the Sunni-Shiite dispute by intervening in Yemen, raising the rhetoric against Iran?
For precisely that reason, because they fear it. Because I know that they're playing with fire.
Yes, makes for instability.
Oh, they are playing with fire, but no, they want to make sure that the side that they want to win wins in Yemen, and the side that Iran wants to win does not win in Yemen. And that's why they've gone for it at the risk of instability. But they're trying to make sure it doesn't come across to their borders.
Now, it is 8 days, if we're counting, until Britain votes. And I'm sure we are all counting. It is. You'll be able to, by the way, mark the election here in the UK by listening to two special editions of Midori House next Thursday and next Friday. I'll be your host for both of those. But, Ivor, let's begin with you. What's quite interesting about this election is that, you know, no one's going to win. There's going to be no single party majority in this country, which is rare for us.
Was rare.
Is rare. But also, it's quite probable that there's going to be no straightforward coalition between two parties as well.
I think we're into very interesting times, apart from political nuts like myself, and I'll be working through the night on May the 7th and into May the 8th. There is the excitement of the results, but clearly the negotiations, working out what combinations will work afterwards, is going to run and run. Now, in Europe, this is not uncommon. Mm. Remind me how long it took the Belgians to form a government, 15 months, I think it was. Yeah. It took us 5 days here last time, and everybody said, this is outrageous, this is incredible. The most dire forecast, if you like, is the fact that the maths will mean that nobody can form a stable government. That's quite feasible, and actually that is the current forecast. That puts us into a very interesting constitutional jam.
Well, and here's the thing. The more interesting thing about that, Tim, is that what's quite possible is that you will have the Conservative Party with the most seats, again, claiming that they've won because they've come first, and yet unable to cobble together any sort of coalition, unofficial grouping that takes them to half the number of seats plus one. And you know, a lot of people have said, well, you know, Britain isn't ready for a coalition of the losers or so on. I'm intrigued. What are the Labour Party, the SNP, anyone else who opposes the Conservatives, what are they supposed to do then? If are they supposed to just allow the Tories to form a government and then just step back and say,
no,
do whatever you want? Because,
well,
that's not going to happen,
no,
is it?
No, the way it works, we don't have a constitution, but we do have precedent. And the precedent is that the leader of the largest party, which is thought to be David Cameron's Conservatives, goes to the Queen. Well, she has to offer him the chance. He looks round and says, is there anyone who wants to join us? If they cannot get...
Can I just point out that's not actually correct?
Go on.
It's not the leader of the largest party. It's whoever is
Prime Minister. Sorry,
whoever
you're right.
Prime Minister at the time.
No, thank
so
you.
It's the incumbent.
So either way, it's going to be David Cameron. Sorry, you're right. The Queen will say to Mr Cameron, can you form a government? He'll look around, try and get the required amount. If he doesn't... The second thing she does is pick up the phone and go on to the second largest party or the second largest party, which will be the Labour Party. Can you now form a government? He then looks around and tries to get the required number. And I don't really see it as a problem. If he could get the Labour, the SNP, this, that, and the other, and get a commanding majority that worked, I don't have a problem with a sort of minority-led government, as long as it's a majority of votes. And it's just something we're going to have to get used to. I look at this country, as I look at other countries, almost as a foreign country. And I'm interested in things such as, is the vote splintering? Is the far right going to move up? Is Scotland going to actually break away? You know, I mean, for me, I'm looking at it as a foreigner looks at
Can I just sort of point out again, I think we've all sort of become slight constitutional geeks now. Again, slightly
oh,
to
no!
correct you there, Tim. It's actually... The Queen doesn't then have to ask Ed Miliband, can you form a government? She actually makes him Prime Minister.
And I'm then, not
no,
convinced.
Yeah, yeah. And then he has to put together... gets the opportunity to do it, whether he can or can't.
Can I raise
you're
a fresh
a judge.
Thought? Because you're both right. the reason we are in this mess, actually, is because of the Parliament 5 years ago, virtually unnoticed, passed this thing called the Fixed Term Parliament Act. We've never had it before. We've now got it. Now, everybody's looking at the details of that, saying, oh, well, we'll only be able to have a second election if this happens or that happens, and it's very difficult. Actually, there's a very simple way we could have a second election. If no Parliament can bound its successors, this Parliament would simply abolish the Fixed Term Parliament Act and agree to have another election.
However, you would need...
You
would need a majority of MPs to vote way.
But if neither of the two leading parties could cobble together a coalition, not a formal coalition, but enough to get what we call a Queen's Speech, their programme through, they could both agree, and if 580 or how many MPs voted for it would not be contentious.
Steve, I hope Monocle's listeners in Jakarta and Adelaide and Paris and Berlin and New York...
Spoil sport.
I hope they're listening to this with more amusement than bafflement.
But that is the thing. It's like every other country seems to know how to run their election, but because in Britain, we've had an unwritten constitution. Yeah. It's only when it comes to things like this, Ivor, that we go, hang on, what happens next?
I am sat in the BBC, I shouldn't mention it, but I was the World Service studio doing the political commentary at the last election. And at 5 a.m, where we were in unknown territory as far as we were concerned, we had phone-ins from people around the world saying, what's your problem? This is normal. Why are you getting into such a tizzy? And we said,
it'll be all right.
There we are. It'll be all right, says Tim Marshall. That's where we are for today's Midori Midori House. The programme was produced by Ben Ryle and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mike Hewin. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. My thanks to Ivor Gaber and Tim Marshall. Tom Edwards will be here next with some music. Danny's up at 1900 hours with the entrepreneurs. And we're back same time tomorrow, 1800 hours here in London, 1300 hours in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Enjoy the rest of your day. Goodbye.